Well, the first thing I think he would do would be to stand up and tell the truth. I mean, he had a great expression that was just tell the truth and watch them scatter.
So the further away the problem is, the easier it is to postpone action on it. And that's essentially what we're doing.
Be real. Because people in New Hampshire are really cool.
I'd say get in the game. This is a problem facing your generation. You have to have a voice in the decision.
Welcome to Facing the Future, brought to you by the Concord Coalition on WKXL, New Hampshire's talk radio station. Tune in each week as we dive into topics related to fiscal policy, like healthcare, taxes, national security, the national debt, and more. You'll hear discussions with experts, elected officials, and industry leaders on how the nation's fiscal and economic challenges impact current and future generations, and we'll explore some of the solutions. I'm your host and Director of Strategic Initiatives for the Concord Coalition, Chase Hageman. Today, Concord's Executive Director Bob Bixby, Bob Lerman, a fellow at the Urban Institute, and Rob Atkinson, president of the Information Technology and Innovation Foundation, will be joining the show to continue our series on topics from the 2019 Fiscally Responsible Economic Growth Agenda and how it might need to change in a post-pandemic economy. This week, we'll focus on workforce investment as well as research and development. But before we dive into today's discussion, let's kick off the program with our first segment, Facing the News, where we will take a few minutes to see what is going on in the world of fiscal policy this week. The budget tracker for CQ Roll Call is reporting that U.S. senators are preparing to leave for their October recess with virtually no prospect of passing new COVID-19 relief legislation ahead of the November 3rd elections. Speaker Nancy Pelosi and Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin have spoken by phone in near daily attempts to narrow differences on pandemic relief between Democrats and the Trump administration, but there has been no indication of any major progress. And Republican senators seemingly have no expectation of any pandemic relief deal this week before heading home. They have balked at any deal that could cost roughly $2 trillion as contemplated by negotiators for Democrats and the Trump administration. As if to underscore their resistance, they pushed their own $519 billion aid bill, which Democrats blocked last week. Up next, Concord Coalition Executive Director Bob Bixby and Robert Lerman, a fellow at the Urban Institute, will join me to discuss how workforce investment and training fit into the long-term economic growth conversation. We'll be back after these short messages. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman, and I'm joined on the show by Bob Bixby and Bob Lerman. You know Bob Bixby, Concord's executive director and a regular contributor on the show. Bob Lerman is an institute fellow in the Center on Labor, Human Services, and Population at the Urban Institute, as well as professor of economics at American University. He's a leading expert on apprenticeship, established the American Institute for Innovative Apprenticeship, and his current research focus is on skills, employer training, apprenticeship programs in the U.S. and abroad, and housing policies. Welcome to Facing the Future, Bob and Bob.
Thank you, Chase.
Thanks.
Pleasure to have you both on the program. We're picking up in our series in October, discussing, at least in each segment, one of the five topics that were included in the Concord Coalition's 2019 Fiscally Responsible Economic Growth Agenda. This segment, we're talking to Bob Lerman about workforce investment and job training. That was the topic of the paper he contributed to this project. And I'm going to kick it off with Bob Bixby first, however, just asking a real general question here, Bob. How does training for jobs for the future fit into long-term economic growth policies?
Well, that question probably should answer itself, but I think that...
I like more detail, though, so lay it on thick.
I think that... let me go back and say why we thought it was important to include a specific paper on this topic in the 2019 series. And actually, looking back, we were incredibly prescient. I had no idea how much further relevant this topic would be in light of the damage to the economy from the disruptions from the COVID-19 pandemic. I think at a basic level, you know, when you look ahead at economic growth and see that the projections from just about every nonpartisan source show that long-term economic growth is projected to be less than it has been in the past by a considerable amount. And that's partially due to a major slowdown in workforce growth as the population ages, and partially a slowdown in productivity. And those are the two key factors. Workforce training, I think, addresses both of those key issues. Certainly, you want to encourage people to join the workforce and increase, you know, get more people in the workforce. And that may involve new and better ways of workforce training. And Bob Lerman can go into many more of those details. That was the point of the paper. But it also helps with productivity as you make workers more productive. Those two factors would both help to drive economic growth. Now, there are no magic bullets here. That's why we had five papers, and there are things that we left out that could contribute to longer term economic growth. But I think this is a very important question, and I'll be interested to talk to Bob a little bit about this. I think it's actually more relevant now because you have this disruption to the economy, you know, the specter of long-term unemployment, people having to retrain even more than they did. I mean, that was part of the story before, but it could be even more now. So that's, in a nutshell, why we included a paper on this in our series.
I think that the ability to help people get into good careers and earn good wages by being productive is critical, because when you don't have that, you have such naysayers about the basic economic system that has been quite successful over the last 100 years. And it sort of avoids us doing bad, unproductive things to the economy in the effort to spread more widely the benefits of prosperity. So making sure that the broad spectrum of the workers does well also prevents us from undertaking unconstructive activities.
So let's back up a step, Bob Lerman, and get into I guess the general proposals in this paper. What did you focus on? Is it a bit of a shift from current policy in the U.S. and how we approach worker training, or is this par for the course, but just calling for a larger focus?
I would say it's mostly a shift. We highlight three broad areas, one dealing with improved information between employers and workers. A lot of young people don't really know the nature of the jobs that are out there even today and that can continue. Even, for example, things in manufacturing that involve very significant skills. Neither they nor their parents have been in such places. And we don't really provide that kind of information growing up, nor do we provide real good direct information about jobs available today. There are efforts to do that, and we're proposing enhanced efforts there. The second component dealt with the issue of how do you document skills above and beyond regular degrees. Increasingly, employers are recognizing, and even lately, the federal government is recognizing that for many jobs, what you want is people who are effective in that kind of occupational skill, maybe some what we call employability skills like listening and teamwork and problem solving. We don't have really good ways for people to document their, let's say, resume. Took on an idea from my former boss, Arnold Packer, called Verified Resume, that allows using either blockchain or other techniques to build up people's resumes with really convincing statements of what they have actually undertaken and accomplished at the workplace. And I would say the third key element, which is the thing I'm most interested in, is to scale American apprenticeship, because it does provide all of these elements and does it in a much more cost-effective way than what we've been doing, which is mainly academic learning through community colleges, trainings, programs that are not really directly linked to the employer. And I think more broadly, the apprenticeship idea is very powerful in helping people become expert in something. And becoming expert in something lends a sort of pride in your occupation. You become part of a community of practice in that field, and not just a job. So these are the three elements that we discuss.
So it sounds like this could potentially be almost partnerships between businesses and governments and educational institutions, or is this largely government intervention? How did you envision achieving those three sort of pillars of the proposal?
Well, let me start with the apprenticeship case. The apprenticeship initiative that we propose does have some government funding, but the bulk of the training would really be paid for by the companies. Now, why would they do it? Well, one reason is they want skilled workers in the end. But the other reason is that the apprenticeship is one of these unique institutions that provides a kind of dual output, because the apprentice is not only learning on the job, but they're undertaking activities on the job that the employers would have to hire people for anyway. So employers are able to recoup some of their training investment through the work experience of the apprentice. Plus, the apprentice is learning the skills in an occupation, but in the context of that organization. So if you take a manufacturing firm, they may learn machining, but they're learning machining on the machines that that company is actually using, or robotic welding, or any kind of field like that. It is true that the apprentice gains generic skills that could be, some of which could be used in other jobs, but in other employers. But the main benefit is going to be to the employer that does the training. Now, the government role is still there. The government role in this case would be funding the off-job learning, selected courses that go along with the work-based learning. And the second thing that I propose is something that's usually ignored, which is having intermediaries get rewarded for actually engaging employers, getting them to start apprenticeships, because American employers are not really well versed in that system. And until we reach that kind of tipping point where employers generally know what it is, this function of an intermediary helping to sell and organize apprenticeships remains vital. So the government could fund those two things, and perhaps a third, which would be creating occupational standards that are widely recognized and widely used.
Those new programs, I think you address that a little bit in the bill about, you know, cost, added cost to the federal government, and ways that that might be helped to be paid for by redirecting some other programs. So there's some opportunities there, I guess, for using funds more efficiently. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. And one thing that distinguishes apprenticeship, it's a mainstream program. It's not meant to be a last resort program for people who fail. And it's something that we want people to aspire to and not resort to. And what it portends is a kind of much more universally well-trained workforce that is equipped to do the jobs that are in the economy. Some of these jobs, by the way, could be government jobs. The current administration did get the Office of Personnel Management to stop using the BA requirement, but use a more skills-based hiring approach for a lot of jobs within government. And we were able to do some of that in Kentucky and a few other places for government jobs. But you know, in the countries that have the most robust systems, apprenticeship really covers a very broad spectrum of the workforce.
I mean, do you think right now that the federal government's involvement in this area is not well targeted? I mean, there's 47 workforce training programs that have been identified by the GAO, and it can have sort of a scattershot effect, or
that's true. But there are only a few that are really highly funded. And the question is, how well do they work? And the answer is, they could work better.
Yeah, well, I guess that's
put
the
it
point.
More nicely. You know, some of these were undertaken for purposes, the Labor Department funding. So we have two main sources. The Labor Department funding, which has long been much more of a second chance. People who are in trouble, people who get laid off, disadvantaged youth. Not a broad human resource investment system. And then we have the educational department, where they provide Pell Grants and other incentives to go to college. There really has been no mainstream effort to train the workforce as a whole and to have them in fields that really work. The community college system, while has some good examples, but overall the graduation rates are abysmal. There isn't a lot of connection between real jobs and what they're learning in the community colleges. Again, there are exceptions. I think that if we moved the needle a bit more, move the ship more toward things that really work, I think we do a much better job for the public for about the same amount of money.
You said a couple of things, Bob, that I really liked. You said an apprenticeship is something you could become an expert in terms of the subject matter, and then you want these to be roles that people aspire to. So I know I don't work in the trades myself, but I know a lot of people who do, and they tell me day in and day out that they're having a hard time hiring qualified individuals to go into even entry-level roles. So I guess my question is there anything in this proposal that helps make this type of job or this type of apprenticeship or role more attractive to young people?
Yes, I think there are plenty of ways of doing that. We didn't go into it too much in the paper. My view is, though more broadly, is that where you have quality apprenticeships, people tend to come. Now, it could be that in certain trades, in certain areas, you need to start a little earlier. You need to start in late high school. What happens, though, is that people are not really all that aware of it, and they're not really knowledgeable about it. And so it's not easy to make that connection at the beginning. But once you get a cohort of kids learning by doing, getting a salary, realizing that a lot of these jobs are that people thought of as not so highly skilled confront problems every day that are different. And the second point is covering a much broader spectrum of occupations. I'm working in the Baltimore area on developing an accounting apprenticeship. I think banking apprenticeships are widely used in England, and we could go a lot further there. We are doing a lot in IT. So we need to do both. We need to expose people earlier when they can see that this could be a really good profession, if they are able to get their act together to even qualify. But right now they don't really, you know, the incentive to get a B plus instead of a C plus in high school, unless you aspire to go to a really good college, is not really that high. But if you had something where you got into one of these programs, and by the way, the mentors in these programs very much watch how you're doing in your courses. So that's an additional incentive. But yeah, I mean, I'm not saying it's a magic wand, but I think there's a lot of progress we could make.
I want to get your take on how the pandemic might have impacted what you put forth in this proposal. Has it identified or helped identify any industries that might be ripe for apprenticeships, or perhaps any weaknesses in the proposal that might need to be beefed up or put a little more?
Right. Well, of course, it depends on how long this pandemic lasts. We have had, interestingly enough, we've recovered a little bit faster than we did in 2009. We've got a long way to go. I mean, the African-American 20 to 24-year-old unemployment rate is 24%. So we've got a long way to go. But among the things I do see as happening that we hadn't really anticipated is a much larger role for online, for less in-person activity. And what I think can be done there is there are now companies and other organizations that are developing a lot better online learning for apprenticeship, virtual reality projects and a variety of things of that sort. So I think we could perhaps do some of that. On the other hand, I do think that this is, I mean, everyone says it's going to change everything forever. I'm a little skeptical of that. I think that certain sectors obviously have been hit extremely hard. And so helping people in those fields return and get into better careers is vital. But I think that, we were looking more at the long run. And I think that perhaps a year from now, when things are returning more to our normal, we still will have a lot of the challenges that we identified in our paper.
Yeah, I think that makes an interesting point, because I mean, that's true across the budget. You know, a huge spike in debt, and the debt deficit will come down as we recover, and we'll get back to the same systemic issues that we were looking at before, albeit from a higher level of debt. But we're still going to have to think about the workforce training and the productivity skills and workforce participation rates, everything that we talked about.
My only one final additional point there is, I think that the onset of the pandemic and where we are even now has made people a little more open to something different than they had been doing before. And that's always a start.
This is Facing the Future. You've been listening to Concord Coalition Executive Director Bob Bixby and Bob Lerman, a fellow at the Urban Institute. We discussed how workforce investment and training fit into the long-term economic growth conversation. Up next, Bob and I will be joined by Rob Atkinson, President of the Information Technology and Innovation Foundation, to discuss federal research and development. Bob and Bob, thanks so much for joining the show.
Thanks, Chase.
Thank you.
We'll be back after these short messages. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman, and I'm joined on the show by Bob Bixby and Rob Atkinson. Bob is the Concord Coalition's executive director and a regular contributor on the show. Rob is founder and president of the Information Technology and Innovation Foundation, or ITIF, which is recognized as the world's top think tank for science and technology policy. He was previously vice president of the Progressive Policy Institute, and he served as the first executive director of the Rhode Island Economic Policy Council. Rob is an internationally recognized scholar, a widely published author, and has testified before Congress dozens of times. He was appointed by then-President Clinton to the Commission on Workers, Communities, and Economic Change in the New Economy. The Bush administration appointed him chair of the congressionally created National Surface Transportation Infrastructure Financing Commission. Say that 10 times fast. The Obama administration appointed him to the National Innovation and Competitiveness Strategy Advisory Board, and the Trump administration appointed him to the G7 Global Partnership on Artificial Intelligence. Welcome to Facing the Future, Bob and Rob. We're happy to have you both here.
Thank you, Chase.
Thanks, Chase. Pleasure to be here.
Well, we are picking up, and I believe this is the last segment in this series in October here, talking about a fiscally responsible economic growth agenda, five topics that the Concord Coalition focused on in 2019. And Rob was kind enough to write one on the topic of federal R&D. Bob, I'm going to start with a question for you. How does that subject fit into long-term economic growth? And I think Rob even touched on how it could reduce the debt.
Well, let me just say that the important thing, you know, what we were looking at in this series was looking at the long-term economic growth, and the projections, frankly, didn't look very good, still don't. And so we looked at what things, I mean, the Concord Coalition is always identified with a sustainable federal debt to GDP ratio. So we've looked at it from the fiscal side. But we wanted to open up a little bit and look at some of the drivers of long-term economic growth and why, aside from a very high debt accumulation, things weren't looking good over the long term. Two issues stand out, and that is a dramatic drop-off in labor force participation. And the other one is stagnant productivity. And so when you look at solutions, things that might help spur long-term economic growth, you look at things that would increase the rate of workforce participation. You particularly look at things that would increase productivity. So who better to turn to for that subject than Rob to look at some innovative ways for increasing productivity that can be done through the federal government, through research and development. And, you know, we asked him to look at some just, you know, be creative and not so much think about the dollars and cents of how much does this cost on an annual basis, but how much might it add to increase productivity over the longer run. So that was the spirit in which we dove into this.
So Rob, when you jumped in with creative policies here, did you have a target level of economic growth in mind? And what were your key takeaways, I guess, in the proposal?
You know, one of the problems, I think, with how economists look at the economy at a business cycle level is they say, well, you know, we can't grow faster than a certain amount or else we'll heat up with inflation. And that's true at one level, but at another level, it's fundamentally not true. What really determines the rate of economic growth or GDP growth, there's two things, as Bob alluded to. It's the labor force expansion or change, and it's productivity. And if we could grow productivity at 10% a year, we could grow GDP at 12% a year without inflation. Now, we're not going to get to 10%, but we could get up higher. So we've been, you know, in the last decade or so at the lowest rate of annual productivity growth, labor productivity growth, you know, probably since the formation of the Republic, but certainly since 1948, when the government started counting this stuff. It's a crisis. We're not raising productivity. We've been able to do it in the past, in the periods of late 90s, early 2000s, we were up to about 2.5% instead of 1.2. In the 60s, we were at 3.4%. So I said, look, what if we could get back to 3.4%? If we could do that, we would raise $1.2 trillion more in net federal revenues by 2039, just because the economy would be so much bigger. We've reduced the projected deficit, although these numbers now are probably meaningless after COVID, but pre-COVID, from $2.6 trillion to $1.3 trillion. So, you know, growing the economy faster it's like this amazing thing. It gives us so much. It raises incomes. It raises revenues. It reduces the debt to GDP. So it's really an important thing to do.
So federal R&D seems like a really big category. So what was the focus within the paper?
When you read what are called growth economists who study why economies grow, there are a number of really, really good ones that show that much of the growth of the per capita growth in the US GDP over the last 70 years has been from technological innovation. Just think about it in our own lives. We use ATM machines instead of having to go to a teller. There are better machines in factories. We use the internet to buy things so we don't have to deal with a clerk. That's really how the big way productivity expands. Well, where does that all come from? Well, a big portion of that comes from research and development. And so one of the big things we wanted to do was spur more research and development, partly in the private sector with a more generous research and development tax credit, where companies get a credit for doing R&D. But while we used to lead the world in 1992 or three when we had the credit, now we're 27th out of 34 nations. Other countries just have better ones or more generous ones. But also in terms of just federal R&D spending itself, now, the problem is that there's no productivity mission in federal R&D. It's to do other things. It's to understand science, or it's to get better weapons, or whatever it might be. But what we argued is we should expand in R&D, federal R&D, and we should target it to things where we know there's going to be productivity benefits. A really good example of that is robotics and autonomous systems. You look at what the Chinese are doing. They're putting in, billions and billions of dollars to develop a better robot technology, because they understand as they move away from being just a low-wage economy, they've got to automate. What are we doing? Well, we have a national robotics initiative in the National Science Foundation, and it's funded, probably 100 times less than what the Chinese are doing, but $40, $50 million a year. Not only that, but it's only allowed to be spent on automation or robotics that never replace a worker. Well, if you're an apple picker, you want a robot that's actually going to go up in the trees and pick those apples. Because I don't know about you, I had a job in high school where I actually picked pumpkins when I was in high school in the fall, and it made me some extra money. It was not a pleasant job. It really wasn't. So we need to think more clearly about how technologies could spur automation and higher productivity, and the federal government could play a key role in that.
You mentioned what other nations focus on and how much they spend. Is your proposal modeled at all after what other countries do, or just an expansion of what the U.S. already does?
It's a little bit of both. Other countries actually have strategies around how do you raise productivity in particular sectors. Look at our construction sector, for example. At least according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, we have not seen any productivity growth in construction for 20 years, zero. So now compare that to other countries. Korea has been seeing about 3% annualized productivity growth in construction. The Europeans what are they doing? Well, they have a big technology initiative for construction innovation and R&D. There's lots of technologies in construction that if we could just get them a little bit better and have the government be a lead buyer of those. So when the government's buying a building, mandate that you use those advanced technologies. That's a good example. Other countries are spending, as I said before, a lot more on robotics, on automation technology for manufacturing. So we need to do more of that. Good example, again, part of the problem is there's no place in the federal government who has a mission for productivity. You read the Federal Reserve, it's not in there. National Economic Council, not in there. Council of Economic Advisors, not in there. You look at our Department of Agriculture, which funds research for farmers. Maybe 5% of that, maybe if we're lucky, goes to automation or automated farming technologies. Very, very little of it. So we just need to be thinking about that and realize that a lot, by the way, some of this isn't we have to do more, although I think we should spend more, but some of it just could we take what we're already doing and really focus it more effectively on productivity enhancing R&D.
Well, you raise a really important subject, which is this mission. But let me premise that with, I think the paper outlines pretty well that federal money, federal investments in productivity and R&D have steadily fallen from heights that they were in the 60s or 70s right through the 80s and are really at rock bottom now. So if there's a productivity lag, there's no surprise that the federal government is not prioritizing. And one of the reasons for that decline, I would argue, is that as people want to cut the budget, they look for places that are easy to cut. And, domestic discretionary spending, where we do a lot of investments, is easy to cut. I think reversing that does require some recognition that this is value spending, and it is very, very important spending for reasons that you've outlined, and that there has to be this mission. So I wanted to focus on that. Is do you have a recommendation for prioritizing this mission? I mean, conceptually, or is there a mechanism for implementing this mission?
Absolutely. One of the challenges is that Congress, well, you're absolutely right, by the way, on the radical decline of federal R&D. It's lower as a share of GDP than it was before Sputnik. And it just keeps, going down really as a share of GDP. I think a couple of things. One is Congress has to take the lead on this, and they have to give guidance to all the R&D agencies, whether it's DOD or DOE or NSF or NIST or others, the Department of Agriculture, and have them come up with some sort of productivity agenda. How explain what it is you're funding and how it leads to productivity. If you just did that simple thing, okay, I'm an agency now, I have to start thinking about this. The same thing, the next president, whoever it will be, could do this as well through the Office of Science and Technology Policy in the White House. The OSTP could lead a agency-wide cross-cutting productivity R&D initiative, something they've never done before. So you could definitely do that. You could task agencies to come up with what are the top five areas that you think would best lead to higher productivity and get them really thinking about that. Again, we're doing nothing about that now. My favorite line of all time was Paul Krugman, who said in one of his books once, productivity is the most important thing in economics, but I'm not going to say anything about it in the book because we economists know nothing about it. Well, the reality is there are some economists who actually do study productivity, just not Paul Krugman, who we know a lot about productivity, but it's not gotten into the federal establishment thinking. It's not part of our economic policy.
So Rob, you mentioned earlier on that the pandemic has likely thrown off some of the fiscal figures in the proposal in terms of its long-term effect on the deficit or debt. I don't necessarily want to focus on that in this question. I'm more focused on, has the pandemic also changed perhaps your perspective or some of the proposals you would make or even highlighted industries that are ripe for this kind of investment?
Sure. There's two things I think that are happening now that make this a promising opportunity, at least for the next maybe year or two. One is China. So China has really reoriented the thinking of a lot of members of Congress. For example, I would commend your listeners to read the Republican House China Task Force report, I think it's called, that Chairman McCaul led. And it's a very, very strong document. But what's striking about it, though, is it's coming from Republicans in the House who've tended to be much more free market over the years. And they're still free market, but they're advocating, for example, doubling federal support of basic research science. That's very unprecedented for Republicans now. So this is a bipartisan change that's happened. You see, for example, the Endless Frontier Act that came out after our report, Bob, hopefully was influenced by that, which is $100 billion in R&D over 3 years targeted at 10 core technologies. Many of them would have a big impact on productivity. And that was Senator Schumer, Senator Young, Democrat and Republican. So that's number one. Number two is, I think, especially if President Biden is elected, there'll be a push for a big stimulus or recovery package early next year. Vice President Biden has proposed $300 billion in spending. Now, look, a lot of that's sort of spending, not really investment, even though some of it's talked about as investment, but some of it is investment and some of it'll be in R&D and some of it could go into these areas. That's the good news. The bad news is once we're past that window and you're facing, massive, massive budget deficits, which you guys know so much more than I do, I think the window closes up again. So that seems like, let's strike now while the iron is hot.
You know, one of the questions that comes up, I've gotten this in just talking about this as something that we need to do. And it strikes me as a very strange question, actually, but it's a strange long-term question, makes sense short-term. And the question is this: if we increase productivity, won't that cost us jobs? And how do you deal with that argument of, you know, productivity is good for rich people and corporations, but it's bad for workers?
Well, first of all, I agree, Bob, that it is a point that a lot of people think about. And frankly, economists have a term called the lump of labor fallacy, this idea that if you eliminate one job, it's gone forever. You know, if that was the case, we'd all be out of work because we eliminated 70% of the jobs because we used to all be farmers. And now we're 3% or 2% are farmers. You know, the U.S. economy is, I don't know, what, six times more productive than 100 years ago, and we have more jobs. So in other words, jobs come from the supply side. We'll always have the, unless we're in a recession, which, you know, but that has nothing to do with productivity. We'll always have enough jobs. The demand, I'm sort of like a Say's Law person here. Supply of labor creates its own demand. So we're not gonna run out of jobs. Historically, when you look at the relationship between productivity and job growth, what you find is it's actually positive. In decades where we have high productivity growth, we have higher labor force growth and we have lower unemployment growth. So the issue, I believe, is not that we're going to run out of jobs. The issue is rather, you know, if productivity doubles, that'll mean somewhat a little bit more labor market change and disruption. And therefore, you know, it is incumbent upon policymakers to make sure that there's adequate community college and adequate unemployment insurance and these other kinds of policies. But, you know, to me, it's just strange thinking about, you know, people saying this now, because that used to be what America was all about. We were the country that had the highest productivity growth. That's why we became the richest country in the world. And now there's this stepping back from it, which is very troubling to me, because unless we keep raising our productivity, you know, we're not going to be able to raise wages. It's as simple as that.
You mentioned earlier on that there really doesn't seem to be, or really isn't, I guess, a productivity goal in the federal R&D process. And that might be the answer, or part of the answer to this question, but where do you anticipate seeing pushback in these proposals, and how do you try to overcome them?
So when was the last time you read in the Financial Times or the Wall Street Journal or the Washington Post or Business Week about the quarterly BLS productivity numbers?
Rarely.
Rarely, if never. Oh, well, better than never. And there's a simple reason for that. They never, ever report them. I get it. I'm on the email chain. I get them every, you know, 9 a.m. in the morning. I'm like, oh, this is terrible. We went down. Or, oh, this is good. We went up. But, you know, the financial media just completely ignores this. Why do they ignore it? Because economists ignore it. Policymakers ignore it. So it's all sort of playing together. So, you know, that's number one, is we just need to be talking about it more. A colleague of mine in Canada used to be, I think he was chief economist for the Toronto Dominion Bank, Don Drummond. He wrote, actually, there's a very good study, a journal on productivity out of Canada called the Journal of Living Standards. And they really do a great job on this. But he said, productivity is like Voldemort in Harry Potter. It's a he who shall not be named. So a lot of policymakers, they don't want to talk about it because it implies job loss and the like. And I understand that. But I think pundits, think tanks, media, companies, we all need to be just talking about the productivity crisis we're in and why we need to do better. And I think if we did that, it would give policymakers a little bit more slack and comfort to talk about it, focus on it.
Yeah, I think just to add this from our point of view, is that if we talk about economic growth over the long term, you have to talk about what drives economic growth. And because if you're not, you're just, you know, people throw out numbers and goals about, oh, we're going to get 4% growth or 5% growth, or no, we're not. And, you know, the only way you can come anywhere close to what we need is to address the structural issues. And that means getting into inevitably you have to get into productivity. You cannot ignore it. And how you increase productivity is terribly important. So it's not just some sort of hypothetical nerd issue. I would always say to everybody, if you care about the long-term federal budget outlook, you have to care about productivity.
Absolutely. I 100% agree, Bob.
This is Facing the Future. You've been listening to me, Concord Coalition Executive Director Bob Bixby, and Rob Atkinson, President of the Information Technology and Innovation Foundation. We discussed the role of federal research and development in long-term economic growth. Thanks for joining the show, Bob and Rob.
Thank you.
You've been Facing the Future. I'm Chase Hageman. Thanks for listening.